Welcome, everyone, to episode 370 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and though we don't know when the NBA is coming back quite yet, we do know it's going to look a lot different when it does. We will talk today, since we have not recorded since this news broke, about Stan Van Gundy going to the Pelicans, and we will also hit the big surprise of the week, Daryl Morey joining the Philadelphia 76ers. Before we get into that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today is a guy who might not have the very stable genius of a title for much longer, Morten Jensen. How's it going?
It's going well. It's a little bit uphill recently. We have some illness in the family, and Denmark has begun acting irrationally in terms of the coronavirus. All the young people are basically deciding that, you know, we're not going to social distance, so our numbers are increasing by the day, which is very infuriating. But outside of that, I'm doing well, and hope the same on your end.
Yeah, well, luckily the coronavirus pandemic is over, according to our government, so you have nothing to worry about.
That's true. That is true. You always look to America to do the right things. That's true.
Leading by example, indeed.
Right.
We are also joined by a very special guest today. Since we're talking so much Pelicans, we have Mason Ginsberg, who writes for Bourbon Street Shots. He is the co-host of the In the Know podcast for Blue Wire. Mace, how's it going, my man?
Good. Just taking it one day at a time as the world slowly comes to an end basically anywhere north of the Mason-Dixon line. We're just like terrified of winter during a pandemic because if we do the right thing, everything indoors is going to shut down and you can't be outside because it's too cold. And so life's great, in other words.
Yeah, I miss Chicago so much. But, you know, as you were telling me earlier that things are starting to shut down again, I'm like, yeah, you know what? Maybe Baltimore won't be so bad, at least like – it's 50 here today. It's not brutally cold. You know, I'm not going to have like a negative 20 day this winter. So I have some reason to be grateful. But Mace, thank you for joining us. Can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter? Anything you'd like to plug?
My name, Mason Ginsberg. You can find me on Twitter and yelling about a bunch of stupid stuff as during the offseason when you know as much basketball things to talk about, right? Main thing I'm doing these days, like you said, is co-hosting with Shemit Dua In the Know podcast or Blue Wire. And so we had to take a little bit of a pause because there was a hurricane that just came through New Orleans in the end of October because 2020 is just the weirdest year ever. But we're doing a series where we're running through off-season previews with all 29 other teams. Basically, just talk a little bit about the teams and also any points of connectivity between them, whether it's a trade, whether it's free agent from one team makes sense for another team. Things like that. So we've released one so far with the Charlotte Hornets. We've got a couple more we've already recorded, releasing soon. So that's what we're doing over at our podcast. So check it out if you're interested.
Very cool. I will look forward to joining you guys to bully you into taking out Horford. So
you've done enough of that on Twitter. I don't know if we can have you doing more of it.
Good. But let's start, Mace, because we haven't recorded since this news came out last week about Stan Van Gundy being the new head coach of the Pelicans. First, just what did you think of the hire?
I'm a big fan. So off the bat, my number one choice throughout the process was Ty Lue. But we also knew from the start that New Orleans was an option for him, such that, you know, he wasn't going to be disappointed if he landed in New Orleans, but it was certainly not his top choice. I think that was pretty clearly going to the Clippers, being they're obviously the closest team to a title. And so I didn't think that was likely, but he was he basically had everything that I was hoping for in a coach. But Stan Van Gundy is not far off. I mean, he's the best option for where the team is right now, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Lue I was looking at as a guy who can also, I thought Lue may have been the best, you know, long-term fit. And I still have questions about Stan Van Gundy, whether he wears on teams and, you know, whether 3 or 4 years from now, is he still the guy if the team gets to the point, you know, fingers crossed, where they're trying to make that leap. But as far as what the team needs right now, I don't know if you could suggest a better option than Van Gundy and what he brings to the table. So definitely happy with it.
Yeah. And I mean, this point got brought up a lot, you know, during when the news first leaked, like in the days thereafter, I guess, how, you know, Van Gundy, especially during his Orlando days, was kind of, you know, I don't want to say the innovator of the way that basketball is played these days, because I think Mike D'Antoni with the Suns as well deserves a large part of the credit for it. But, you know, he did have the four out look with Dwight Howard and four shooters, and, you know, it was like Turkoglu and Rashard Lewis. Mm-hmm. These weren't small guys, so it wasn't as unconventional as you've seen now. But obviously in New Orleans, he's inheriting Zion Williamson, who is a one-of-a-kind prospect. I don't know that he has a very clear positional designation. How do you think his experience coaching Dwight in particular in Orlando, but, you know, also wherever else he's coached, how do you think that's going to help him with Zion and the rest of this roster?
Yeah, I mean, broadly speaking, I think maybe the most underappreciated thing about Stan Van Gundy is his ability to innovate. So he's not, you know, you look at older head coaches in the league, and I think Pop notwithstanding, a lot of these guys, you think, just they do what they do, and they kind of impose their structure on the team. Mm-hmm. And I think Van Gundy's just not that guy. He's gonna, you know, figure out what he's got and adjust accordingly. There are certain stylistic things that I think he'll still try to do. I thought I was actually right before this podcast reading Danny LaRue's Pelicans offseason kind of primer, and one thing he mentioned was that Van Gundy likes to play these four out, one non-shooter type lineups. And so if that's the case, that you know, maybe he tries to do some things like that. But I think as far as the overall thoughts around what the Pelicans are going to do, he's going to let the players he has dictate that. And I think he's shown time and time again that that's what he does as a coach. He's adaptable. And I think that's what's exciting, is really we're not going to try to force fit Zion to being something. He's going to see what he's got and make the best of it.
Yeah, for sure. Mort, what did you think of the hire?
Oh, I loved it. I think Stan was a guy who got a bad rep for a couple of years, but I think in large part that was because he also was responsible for personnel decisions in Detroit. That really wasn't a case of his coaching necessarily. Now, is he a championship-level coach? That remains to be seen, but he's certainly one of those point A to point B coaches, which I think is very crucial for the Pelicans at this point. I mean, they're so young. There's so much potential on that roster. Like, he's going to come in. He's going to instill discipline. He's going to have them preach defense. I can only see this benefiting so many of the young guys moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm equally optimistic about it. I think Mace, like you, Ty Lue was my personal choice for the Sixers when all this turmoil first started, the coaching overhaul, I should say. It was pre-Doc availability. So I understand the impulse of wanting him, because I think he does kind of have all of the characteristics you would want. I think your fears about, you know, whether Van Gundy is the guy to get them from point A to point B and then from point B to point C, that could prove correct in a couple of years. But like you, I also think this is a really good hire for where they are right now, and to at least get them from, you know, you can't go from whatever they were, 30 some wins, to championship team overnight. It's going to take time, and luckily they have time. I mean, they have a bunch of young guys. It's not like they should not be in any rush to say we are in a win now window right now. Like, Zion is going into his second year. Brandon Ingram is just about to come off of his rookie contract. Lonzo is still on his rookie deal. Josh Hart's still on his rookie deal. You still have Jackson Hayes, Nikhil Alexander Walker, you know, at like every draft pick from the Los Angeles Lakers for the next 5 years. So they have a good window, and I have all the confidence in the world in David Griffin to manage this thing patiently and not rush it forward. If I were a Pelicans fan right now, I'd be feeling pretty good about myself.
Yeah, at the same time, though, I mean, they've got some decisions to make pretty quickly, mm-hmm. right? Especially as it comes to Lonzo. And I think they're going to – Josh Hart makes a lot of sense to this team, and I think there's reason to expect – they may even try to get an extension done this offseason with Josh. But I think Lonzo, you've got to make a decision about him, I think, in fairly quickly. I don't know if it's this offseason or if it's in the season next year, but that's one key decision, I think, for this team that's got to be made. But I think apart from the Lonzo topic aside, I think you're exactly right. Like, they've got some time to figure some things out. But at the same time, how fast do you want to move? I mean, you've got this transcendent talent like Zion, and you've got BI, most improved player. You've got talent to make a move, but how quickly do you want to move? And also, Western Conference is always the Western Conference, and so how much sense does it even make to try to push things?
right, exactly. So let's get into some of their big offseason decisions, since you brought up Lonzo and BI. I mean, Ingram, I think, is number one on the list. He will be a restricted free agent whenever free agency opens. We still don't really know. I assume it's pretty well established at this point that they're going to offer him the max. I'm guessing the only real question is, like, you know, he'll probably want a five-year deal with a player option in the fifth year. They'll probably want full five-year deal, no player option. But I'm assuming that's the only obstacle, right? Like, I can't imagine they're going to say, we're not even going to offer you a max. Go get an offer sheet and we'll match it, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, EPIs can argue for the 4+1. Pelicans will try to get 5 flat, you know, with the leverage being you can go sign an offer sheet for a 3+1 somewhere else. Obviously, different percentage raises. But, I mean, we've seen this thing play out time and time again, and usually the player gets the negotiating leverage here and gets the 4+1. Who knows what this current pandemic-like environment does to negotiations. I still think, ultimately, it ends up being a 4+1, but I do think some market factors regarding, for example, if he were to go test and you try to play a leverage card on testing the restricted free agent market, the teams that have cap space are not exactly places you want to go typically.
Right.
And so, you know, what is that actual leverage? How much does he want to play that card? And also, again, the percentage raises, you know, with going with a different team are not what they would be staying in New Orleans. And so I think the Pelicans may have a little bit more leverage than usual. Mm-hmm. And also in the sense that Brandon Ingram is not like a top 10 type player who's getting a max deal. But I mean, regardless, it's one of those two things. It's 5 or 4+1. I think that's pretty well established at this point.
Yeah. I mean, Atlanta is really the only team out there with potential max cap space that would be at all appealing to him, I would think. Like Charlotte, Detroit, New York, you could use him as leverage. But as you said, the Pelicans could very easily just call his bluff and be like, really? You want to join the Detroit Pistons with absolutely no talent? Be our guest.
Yeah, man. Can you even use New York as a leverage point these days? Like, isn't that just I don't think that works, right?
They have money, but like otherwise.
Yeah, but like who in their right mind would even want to go there? That's bluff.
Right.
And I'm just thinking about the defense of John Collins, Trae Young, and Brandon Ingram on the same team. Oh man. Oh, boy.
Clint Capella would have his work cut out for him, that's for sure. Yeah, so I think, as you said, the Ingram thing, I don't think there's any chance that he is not in New Orleans at the start of the 2020-21 season. I think the bigger question, of course, is Jrue Holiday, who's going to come up a ton in trade rumors over the next few weeks. If you were David Griffin Mace, what would you do with Jrue? Would you be shopping him, or would you try to keep him around, you know, knowing his importance as a two-way player and as a veteran leader? He's got definitely under contract next year, and he's got the player option 2021, so he could walk next offseason hypothetically.
Yeah, so I think that maybe the biggest thing that gets that's underappreciated nationally about Jrue is really the relationship he's formed with the city of New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Like they're with the team essentially, and the Benson family. I mean, like back, if you remember back when his wife had those health complications when she was pregnant with their first child, the Pelicans did everything absolutely the right way. That shouldn't give them any brownie points, really. That's just doing the right thing. But at the same time, like the relationship formed at an earlier point in Jrue Holiday's tenure with New Orleans, and since then he's done a ton of work in the community. Obviously, he got the Teammate of the Year award, which sounds flimsy, but it's meaningful when you think about things like this. Mm-hmm. And so, all that being said, if they get a great offer for him, I still think they may consider pulling the trigger. But I think my one takeaway here is that keeping him is a totally fine option. Mm-hmm. keeping Jrue Holiday with the intent to re-sign him. And I think if they do that, they'll have a kind of an idea of what they think it'll cost to keep him. And if they feel like it's reasonable, sure. Like let's keep one of the best dudes in the NBA, just straight up Jrue Holiday, in New Orleans until he retires. I'm very content with that. And so it really just comes down to what the offers are out there. And so, the fear obviously is you run into a situation like you end up with AD and the Lakers, and that, you know, the Lakers are bidding against themselves, and they did a fantastic job of bidding against themselves, by the way. But that's one thing you can be afraid of. If the Nuggets, for example, say, well, we don't really want to pay what it's going to cost to get Drew, suddenly you're left with just, like, say, the Brooklyn Nets, for example, mm-hmm. and do they really have the pieces that you want. But that being said, flip side to that argument is Drew Holiday is probably the best player who could be reasonably attainable via trade this offseason. So it's such a flimsy answer, but it really does depend on what the offers are. I just say that, again, I'm very okay with keeping him if it comes to that.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense. I mean, I don't think they should feel any pressure to give him away for, like, pennies on the dollar, because, you know, it's not like he's Victor Oladipo, where it's just been, like, a nonstop leak of rumors that he is going to leave next offseason. One, we don't even know if he's going to opt out. I mean, it seems more likely than not, but, like, who knows mm-hmm. what the financial environment is heading into next season. I mean, we very well could still be dealing with some ramifications financially from the coronavirus pandemic. So, you know, it may make sense for him to opt in. And if not, you know, as you said, I think the relationship with him in the city, and also, like, they have a team, a young nucleus of talent that's only going to get better. It's not like he's looking at the rest of his team and he's got, like, a bunch of washed 35-year-olds. He's like, I'm going nowhere. I'm getting out of here. It's like, yeah, I could, you know, stay with this team in the twilight of my prime and, like, have guys like B.I. and Zion kind of carry me. I can take more of a complimentary role, and that might fit me better than having to be the alpha somewhere. So it could be mutually beneficial for the two sides to stay together beyond next season. But, you know, hypothetically, if they were to shop him, first of all, which teams would you be entertaining offers from if you're the Pelicans?
Man, that's a really tough question. I don't have a good answer for you. It's just because I was trying to wait to figure out who we thought the market would be. There was some speculation that I feel like the most consistent name again that's popped up is Brooklyn, mm-hmm. but like I'm not enamored with any, like, Jared Allen. Like, the Pelicans have Jackson Hayes, and I think they're hoping he can be better than Jared Allen. I mean, I'm not saying he's going to be a star, but I think that going out and getting a guy like Jared Allen is kind of duplicative with what they have with from Hayes' rookie year. You know, and then you've got guys like LeVert, who's I'm still not sold on the type of total impact he has on a team. I think he's a great creator and he can go get a bucket, but you know, between him and BI, like, are those two guys who are too similar? It's asset accumulation, right? I'm not trying to get I'm not all going crazy for who's the best fit. It's similar mm-hmm. to a draft strategy. Like, just get assets and, like, set yourself up for the next move, right? Don't trade thinking you're trying to get perfect fits for right now. But I'm just not that blown away with what the Nets have to offer. And I think that kind of ties into how I'm not that driven to move him, just because I don't know the team. Like, what do you think? Give me a couple teams who you think are, like, Drew Holiday can put us in the contender bucket, and we would maybe give up a decent amount to go get him. What teams come to mind for you?
Yeah, I have one, but I want to pivot to Mort quickly because he just wrote an article about the Nets and Milwaukee with, you know, why Chris Middleton could be their third missing piece, and Nets fans apparently absolutely hated it. This was an episode that
Middleton is so criminally underrated. I hate it.
Yeah. I think what you argued it very well. It came up, you know, we came up with the idea on a recent episode, and, like, I think it makes sense for both sides, but, you know, that dovetails into the LeVert concerns, which I know that was one of the more contentious issues
right
from Nets fans.
Yeah, well, Nets fans love their guy, and I think part of it, it's the intrigue and it's the constant injuries. So you've never really seen him, you know, healthy over an extended period of time, so there's this allure. There's not unsimilar to the Chicago situation with Lauri Markkanen either, mm-hmm. where there's still this very big hesitancy in terms of trading them, even though it might actually be the best decision to moving forward. So LeVert, for some reason, has just occupied the hearts of Nets fans, and they believe he is, like, one guy actually said that he might have more trade value right now than Chris Middleton, which, what? You know, it's
unbelievable.
Right? I mean, and this is, once again, it's one of those things where the aesthetics comes in, because, you know, Caris LeVert is a guy who will create highlights for you. He'll be on SportsCenter. He'll have these, you know, double crossovers, angle breakers, and step back threes, and all the things that look nice. And then you have Chris Middleton, who like buries 7 mid-range jump shots in a game and who doesn't make the highlights, but who's just so much better. And I think that was why Nets fans were like, all three? No way, no way. But I think it's a fair deal. I'll say as much just to wrap up the Drew thing. You know, I think the hiring of Stan Van Gundy is just so perfect from Drew, because now you're really going to see his defense get just, it's already elite. But I think with Stan, he's just going to open him up so much more. I have a feeling that our perception of Drew right now, which is high and very, very good, is going to be even better next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fair point. And I think the one guy who I know, the one vet who I feel like is a total lock to stay in New Orleans because of this hire is J.J. Redick. Mm-hmm. I mean, before they hired Stan, you could have absolutely seen him move even like this mid-season. I guess if the wheels totally fall off the bus and things don't work out with Stan, you could see J.J. still moved in season. But I think he's almost a lock to stay for his full contract next year. Yeah, Drew, I think some people maybe overstate how much this Van Gundy hiring means for keeping him. But I think Mort, that's a great point. And that we've seen Drew be so good on defense for so long, but it hasn't always resulted in good team defense.
Right.
Part because of the style. Fast-paced teams that like try to work a lot in transition, often their turnover rates are higher, and you're going to suffer on defense sometimes. But also, just they've had such bad perimeter defense beyond Drew. He's had to do so much himself. You saw him having to guard Kevin Durant, LeBron James, like all these, and he's great. He's one of the most underrated defenders in the league in the post. But like he just can't match up with guys that much taller than him and have a ton of success all over the floor. You know, The challenges the Pelicans have had on defense really stem from some of the other guys they've had and been so poor. I am really excited to see what Stan can do for the overall team defense for the squad.
Yeah, I'm sad about JJ because I was hoping to steal him somehow, but I don't think that's going to happen.
You think he wants to return to Philly? I mean, well, have you Brett listened Brown's to gone. Him on the podcast? He's just like, nope.
That it's a whole new team now. He likes Joe, but. Yeah. But to go back to the like which team should be after Drew, I think
Denver.
Yeah, that's definitely one of them. And
what's your offer? Like, yeah. That's what I struggle with. Yeah. They're not going to give up Murray, and they're not going to give up Porter Jr. I don't think I'm saying yes to anything else.
They should give up Michael Porter Jr. if Drew is the one they're getting back, though. I mean, I love the intrigue of Michael Porter Jr. as much as anyone, but here you have a very known commodity, one of the best defensive point guards in the NBA, who can also switch over and play the two. Like, he will be interchangeable with Jamal Murray. I mean, that would just be such a slam dunk for Denver to get that. I mean, I would sacrifice MPJ in a heartbeat if that was the deal breaker.
Well, and I think you could use Gary Harris as the salary matching, and he's, I don't know if he's a negative asset, not like an overly negative asset. I don't
financially think... negative, I think is fair to say.
Yeah. I call him a mild negative asset, but yeah, like you're saying, not a huge one.
Yeah, so I'm thinking, MPJ is obviously the big trade chip here, and then you can also get off of Gary Harris's contract. Like, do Harris and MPJ for Drew? That's at least mildly intriguing. It's like a challenge trade, basically, for both sides. I mean, I don't know that Denver feels great about doing it. Because there's a good chance that if MPJ hits the ceiling, that backfires magnificently on them. But
right,
there is still the risk there with MPJ. I mean, like we saw the flashes in the bubble and in the playoffs. I mean, there is a star in the making if he stays healthy and if he hits the ceiling. But we don't know that either of those things
and
are going to happen.
Vaccinated,
yeah, and that's right. But more as you were saying, like Drew Holiday is. You know what you're going to get out of Drew Holiday. You know, put him next to Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic, that Nuggets team is going to be a legit threat. We still got, Will Barton, even if Gary Harris is going. You could re-sign Jeremy Grant. Like, that's a terrifying starting five right there.
Right. Drew is an all-star who just hasn't made the all-star game because he's in the West. Like, mm-hmm. he made it back in Philly, which almost didn't count. But, like, he is undoubtedly an all-star caliber player. And I don't know why people don't really understand just how much he would improve a contender who is somewhat weak on the guard spots.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I mean, he landed in he's when Partno did his player tiers and on the Athletic. I mean, he's he's firmly in that top 25 category. I think that's, I don't think that's debatable for anyone who really, really knows the game. Just the question is how to, and I feel like he's such a malleable fit on a lot of teams. You know, the one thing you can probably pick at is it's one of the most inexplicable things I can find about any player. If you look at Jrue Holiday's career and split his first half of his career and the second half of his career and look at his 3-point shooting, it's mind-boggling. Like, he somehow forgot how to shoot threes. And, like, the sample size on the first half of his career is more than enough to feel like it's a sustainable trend. And then, like, ever since, he's struggled. And so that's the one thing I can't figure out for the life of me, what's going on with that. But, yeah, otherwise, I mean, that's the one, I think, nitpick you can make about you know, his fit on any sort of team. Like, if you put him with another guy in the backcourt who can't shoot, does that cause issues? But he's willing to shoot. I mean, he'll pull up. And so, you know, I really feel like he's a guy that can help a lot of teams. And so, yeah, we'll see how eager is Denver is to get a deal done. I'm just kind of skeptical that and they put MPJ on the table.
I have a few other possibilities, at least teams that should be interested. I don't know that they could put together, one team could put together a pretty intriguing trade package. Like Dallas, I think, definitely going to be interested in shopping for a third star, but I don't know. You know, you're not giving up Kristaps or Luka, I don't think. You're definitely not
waiting for 2021. I keep telling you.
Yeah.
They're going for Giannis, and they're going to get him in 2021.
I know. But if they, you know, if they pivot, like they have Tim Hardaway Jr. for salary matching, they've got a number of other guys in that like 8 to 11, 12 million range. So the salary matching is easy enough. They just gave up so much for Kristaps that I don't think, like, Tim Hardaway and Seth Curry is not doing it for Drew, I don't think.
No. Yeah. I don't think so. But those picks are useless, right? Those picks are totally useless because they're going to be so good for so long now.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the other one would be Miami, I think, could have the interest again. Like, I know they're saving up for 2021, but, I mean, you know, they do have Hero, Duncan Robinson that they could dangle. Like, those guys should be interesting to New Orleans. I just don't know. You know, it might have to be like a Gorgui Dragic sided trade plus Tyler Hero or something like that. I don't know the exact offer that they could make because otherwise they don't really have the salary on their books already. Like Andre Iguodala and Kelly Olynyk should not be of much interest to the Pelicans.
Yeah, it would have to start with Hero. And the question from there is how much more does it take? And I think, you know, I think Heat fans would, after what they saw from Hero in the playoffs, they would say, well, that's either no, Hero's untouchable,
right,
or nothing more. And if you're looking at his long-term outlook, you have to look at the trajectory, right? It's like, yeah, he had a great rookie year. What do we think his actual ceiling is, given his, you know, given any other limitations that you see from him? And so I think I agree with you that they could probably put together a package that would entice New Orleans, but would they want to, and does New Orleans feel like it's a fit? I think tough questions, but I do agree that they're an option if they want to really get serious about it.
Yeah. The other two that came,
Ryan, I wonder if Dallas is a good fit though, like just to go back to that, because when you look at a guy like Luka who just has the ball in his hands so much and is the primary creator, don't you, like, especially next to Luka, don't you need more of a guy who's like a knockdown shooter who can play off the ball instead of another on-ball creator?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think that's, but I think Drew kind of thrives in that off-ball situation. Like, I as much as, you know, Rondo had his limitations in New Orleans, I think Drew kind of thrived in that shooting guard, where he wasn't a true second banana, but at least he was, I'd say Rondo was more of the guy who was point guard, and Drew kind of helped out. So I think that's it. But I think your point, though, Mort, is fair in that Luka's like a James Harden type who's just going to dominate the ball all the time.
Right.
And so in that situation, yeah, maybe Drew isn't the right fit there. So that, yeah, it kind of makes sense talking it through a little bit more.
Yeah. The other two that came to mind as teams that would be interested, one, the Clippers, given this whole Kawhi wants a point guard thing. But again, it's just like, I don't, you know, they gave away so much to OKC already. Like, I don't think Patrick Beverley and Lou Williams or Patrick Beverley and Zubac, I don't know that gets them in the door necessarily.
Yeah. Sorry, Landry Shamet isn't doing it for
me. And then the other one would be...
What about the Bulls?
The Bulls?
Yeah,
I thought we're Bulls doing fans. Lonzo... I thought we were doing Lonzo for Markkanen and calling it a day.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. That's been brought up a lot. No, but I know over the past couple of years, Bulls fans have been very vocal about their passion for Jrue Holiday. And I think there's some logic in the whole idea of pairing him with Zach LaVine in the backcourt. But also, you know, obviously, that would mean the Bulls, you know, pivot into sort of a win-now mode, which I don't think they will. But I think the idea of combining Jrue and Zach is at least intriguing. And I would assume they have the pieces to go get him. You know, they have the fourth overall draft pick. They have Kobe White. You know, there's Markkanen. I don't think they're going to give up Carter, but there are a lot of components there that you can move around.
Yeah.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. And they have, I mean, Otto or Thad for salary matching.
Right. Exactly.
They, yeah. It's just, as you said, I think the question is, like, do you want to speed up that timeline? Because, you know, if Jrue leaves in a year, are you giving up, like,
right,
any, you know, either Kobe or marketing the number four pick, whatever? Are you giving it up for a year rental when your upside is, like, the number seven seed?
Yeah, no, I, if I'm the Bulls, I don't do it, but I do think it's an interesting discussion because I do like the idea of a LaVine Holiday backcourt, though. I think that could be very, very potent.
Yeah, and I think for New Orleans, it would have to start with two of Kobe White, Wendell Carter, and that pick. And so I don't know what it would take ultimately, but I think that's where New Orleans would say bare minimum. And so is that really something that the Bulls want to do? To both of your points, and so I would agree. The answer is no, but there are pieces there that would entice me. So that's fair.
Yeah. Well, if it was Kobe White and four, I'd probably do it. I'm not super high on Kobe White.
Wow.
Yeah, and I do think New Orleans still, and I think they ask for more on top, and then that's where the Bulls start saying, well, then we're not going to deplete all of our young assets just for Jrue Holiday, who might leave in a year. So I think that's kind of where the conversation then ends.
Right, right.
Yeah, the only other team that came to mind for me was Milwaukee, because, like, you know, of course they'd love to turn Eric Bledsoe into Jrue Holiday, but it's like, what is that other piece that you're including? Like, they get the Pacers pick this year, a late first round pick at a bad draft. Like, Dante DiVincenzo, I don't think the Bucks necessarily have the ammo to upgrade from Bledsoe to Jrue unless they loop in a third team somehow.
Yeah, I don't see it there either. As much as I love the Lopez twins. I loved Rob. One of my most frustrating moments as being a New Orleans fan was the Robin Lopez trade, when he had to be salary filler to get Tyreke Evans and like a throw in, and just like the chain of events that unfolded because New Orleans did not have Robin Lopez. Omar Asik was like kind of a direct byproduct of not having Robin anymore, and AD not wanting to play center. And so, man, if that just had, I always wonder what would have happened if they had kept Robin on the team and not had to send him out as like filler for Tyreke. But we'll never know.
You can rectify that mistake by trading Jrue Holiday for Eric Bledsoe and Robin Lopez.
Perfect.
Redemption is right here. All right, guys, let's pivot to the other big news of the week now, and that is Daryl Morey. He is in negotiations. It should be official as soon as this weekend to join the Philadelphia 76ers as their new president of basketball operations. Elton Brand, their general manager, is theoretically staying on board, even though, you know, as of a week ago, there were rumors that they weren't going to hire anyone above him, and they were kind of reshuffling their office or front office below him. Mace, what was your take when you
have such an hard on right now, don't you?
No, I'm genuinely curious, you know, what the outside perception is of this move. Like, obviously, Sixers fans are very excited. So, you know, Mace, what's the outside perspective of Morey to the Sixers?
I think the Sixers saw an opportunity and they jumped on it. My only question is how long has this actually been in the works versus what we'd be led to believe? I mean, I enjoy the Houston Rockets aspect of this more than anything, which will be a secret to nobody. The whole, you know, the whole deal with Tillman, and, you know, going from, oh, maybe we'll go get Ty Lue, and then Ty Lue, within like an hour or two of his interview in Houston, agrees with the Clippers to be their head coach. Like, who knows how much he was lowballed, and then suddenly Morey's out too. And now in 2 weeks, you know, 2 weeks ago, he was saying, I just want to spend time with my family, understanding that it's it's more convenient, locally speaking, for him to do that and still have this job. But still, like, it seemed like the tone just shifted, and all of a sudden now he's got this huge contract, or long-term contract with Philly, and the Rockets are just like, look like a, I mean, I like their hire of Silas as their next head coach. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great, I think he's going to be good. I don't know if he's the right guy to manage Russ and James Harden as his first head coaching job, but I think he's a talented coach who makes a lot of sense at whatever low cost he probably came for that owner. But yeah, it was all just so, the chain of events was so hilarious and predictable from the start for Houston. And I think, you know, again, kudos to Philly for jumping on it. And now they've got some organizational shit to figure out, obviously. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, I mean, you go get, yeah, I think it's like players, you go get talent, figure out the rest later.
Yeah. It's just like, I still can't really believe that they just kind of fell ass backwards into Doc Rivers and Daryl Morey. Like, their process throughout this offseason was just so backward the whole time. Like, you know, they pledged to redo their front office that didn't actually do anything, and they were like narrowing between D'Antoni and Ty Lue, and then Doc Rivers becomes available, and all of a sudden he's their coach 3 days later. And then now, you know, again, last week they were like, oh, we're not going to hire a PBO, and now Daryl Morey's the PBO. So it's, yeah.
And also there's alignment there, right, between Doc and Morey. I think those two, mm-hmm. those two like each other, and I think the question just is about Morey, and then, oh, hi, rest of the front office, I'm in charge now.
Right.
So, like, yeah, so that, I think that's the tricky part. Maybe not as much about Doc. I think that they're, you know, I think they'll work together just fine.
Yeah. So, Mort, I think one of the big questions now for the Sixers, I mean, obviously, like, they're way capped out. Regardless of where the salary cap ends up, they're going to be in tax territory, well into tax territory. I'm going to guess that was one of the questions that Morey asked in the job interview, was like, are you going to make me salary dump players so I have to get under the luxury tax every year? So I think Josh Harris is willing to pay the tax, but the roster does not fit super well together. And, you know, one of the prevailing themes that came out right when Morey got hired was like, Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid aren't necessarily great fits for, you know, a three-point heavy isolation team that the Rockets were over the last few years. So, you know, if what do you think Daryl Morey is looking at right now, like inheriting this roster? Is he like, I could win with this as is, or is he already thinking we got to take a sledgehammer to this thing and break up Ben and Joel?
No, I think he's definitely looking at those two as the players moving forward, and then flanking them with shooters, and hopefully just getting it into Ben Simmons' head that he needs to shoot threes. I mean, I wrote as much on Twitter after that hire came out that, okay, I no longer believe that the Sixers should get blown up, and I've been very vocal about this on this podcast. I definitely thought this sledgehammer would be necessary, but when you get a guy in like Daryl Morey, like a caliber of his, you know, with that resume, I think you at least owe it to Ben and Joel to see what he can do around those guys before taking that sledgehammer to anything. You know, what if he somehow figures out to unlock this? I mean, the talent level, as we've discussed so many times before, is ridiculously high. It's just a matter of making it work in unison. So far, that just hasn't been done in large part because, you know, Brett Brown was maybe a little bit too nice of a head coach. Like, he wasn't really that demanding. The front office was just in shambles ever since, you know, Hinkie stepped down. Maybe this is what it's, you know, this might be, what do you want to call this? Like, not the process 2.0. That's too cheesy, but maybe this is what gets the process back on track and actually completes it.
Yeah. Well, when Hinkie stepped down / got fired, whatever you want to call it, I think it was Scott O'Neill, their CEO, who tweeted process to progress. That was the hashtag. And it immediately got dunked on by all of Sixers Twitter. So when the, when the Morey news came out, I tweeted process to progress back to process. So it's fun how it came full circle.
Process to progress to real progress.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. I think you're right, though, Mort. I was skeptical that, you know, Elton Brand came out when they fired Brett and was like, we're not trying to trade Ben or Joe. Like, we're not considering it. And I took him for his word, but, like, I've been telegraphing this for a while. I kind of thought this was Joel Embiid. We're heading into Joel Embiid's last year with the Sixers. Like you, now that Morey is in charge, I'm less resolute in that belief. Like, I have more confidence in the front office being able to execute a long-term plan and kind of dig their way out of the mess that they've created for themselves the past few years. I still think it's going to be really hard to trade Al Horford or Tobias Harris without giving up a ton in return. I think it would have been hard regardless, but now that the cap is going to presumably fall, you know, lower than it was projected, like probably going to stay flat at 109 million instead of going up to 115 like it was projected to do, teams are going to be reluctant to take on 3 or 4 year deals with that much money still left on them. So, you know,
That's not a problem though, because here's the thing. I think people are overestimating just, you know, the contract of Tobias Harris. Yes, it's bad, but now he's going to be a part of a team where the team president is very, very analytically inclined, meaning next year we might actually see Tobias Harris as a completely different player. You know, he took, off the top of my head, like five and a half threes per game.
Something
along those lines. I could see that double.
Yeah.
I could see him becoming a vastly different player just by having the green light to basically, you know, say, you know what? Take 10, 12 threes a game and unlock yourself in a completely new way, thus lessening that, you know, the hurt of that contract.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I totally agree about Tobias. I'm curious, is there a player now? I don't really want to call Horford untradeable, but is there another big contract out there that you feel like Morey may have his eyes on as a guy who fits better with the way he thinks about the game versus maybe other people do? I don't really have an idea here. I mean, I don't think they're going to trade him for John Wall, but is there a guy out there that you feel like maybe like it you still have to give up, put an asset against him or in addition to Horford, but maybe it's like a smaller asset because you're also trading for a huge, probably overpaid contract.
Unfortunately, he has only 1 year left on his deal, which makes him more valuable. But I think Otto Porter would be fantastic in a Daryl Morey-led team, assuming health, of course. But those deals wouldn't align because that would just be such a home run for Philly because, you know, why would the Bulls do that? But it's players of that ilk, I want to say, if those are out there. I don't know who that – could that be Gary Harris potentially? Maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why this is what it always comes down to. It's like you can identify players that would make sense for Philly, but it's like why would the other team say yes? This is what I – you know, the most popular thing on Sixers Twitter has been Horford plus something for Buddy Hield, because Buddy Hield is, you know, very discontent in Sacramento, not returning Luke Walton's phone calls, like going into the first year of his 4 year deal. They're planning on re-signing Bogdanovich. He got benched in the middle of the year, didn't take kindly to that. So, like, I do think the Kings would be willing to move Buddy Hield. The question is, why do they do it for Al Horford? Like, what can the Sixers sweeten that package with? And I don't have a good answer.
I'm shocked that... So no one... Has Kevin Love even come up on the radar?
Yeah, he has.
The contracts match perfectly. Obviously, I think... I mean, if it's a one-for-one deal, that's a home run for Cleveland, I think. But I also don't know... I don't necessarily think you'd have to attach a ton more to Horford to make that work. And I feel like he fits better with a Morey team than Horford does. Do you disagree?
No, I don't. Okay. My problem with trading Horford for another big, I mean, I understand conceptually, like, you know, Horford, they brought him in because they thought he could play next to Embiid, which did not really prove true. But they also wanted a legit backup for Embiid because they overreacted to the Toronto series where they got annihilated every time he stepped off the floor. So Horford is still good Embiid insurance, and Horford and Simmons, when Embiid was off the court, did function somewhat well together. So I think there is some value in keeping him. I don't necessarily think he can play 35-plus minutes a game, nor should he. I don't want to bring in another big necessarily, especially one who, you know, I wouldn't feel great about playing Kevin Love at the five a ton, just because I think Tobias Harris is better off at the four than the three. And, you know, I don't want to shoehorn him into playing that smaller role. And I think that's what a Kevin Love would do. So that's why I would look toward more of a guard or a wing.
Wiggins.
That is the one. That's the one that has come up as well. And I don't hate it really for either side. Again, it's like I don't think it's a one-for-one deal. if it was, I would sign off immediately. Like, I think it would be probably Horford and Matisse and maybe number 21 for Wiggins. And, like, that feels like a lot. That's the problem with any Horford trade, too, is, like, are you trading so much that you're not really helping yourself even though you're getting off of this big contract and ill-fitting player? Because, like, I don't know. You know, if Joel Embiid does go down, then cool, okay, then you've got Andrew Wiggins, Ben Simmons, and Tobias with, like, no center. So
if your options were keep him or Horford in a first, let's see, not a good one, like a lottery protected or something, mm-hmm. for Kevin Love, do you do that if that's your only option?
I would probably not do it this off season and see what they look like under Doc, and, you know, as Mort said, see if they start launching more threes because of Morey. And then, you know, you can always reevaluate closer to the trade deadline next year. Like, that Kevin Love deal isn't going away in particular. You know, both guys have 3 years left of their contract. Like, Cleveland is in no hurry. They're not going to, like, find someone in a hurry to take Kevin Love. So I don't hate the idea. And I'm sure, you know, I wrote a thing in Forbes when Morey got hired, you know, kind of saying, like, he's probably going to kick the tires on as many Harris and Horford trades as he can. I think Horford's the more likely of the two to be traded just because he's got the smaller contract. And, you know, Harris played with Doc Rivers on the Clippers, had like a career year there. So I think they're going to try to really maximize what they can get out of him and maybe resuscitate his trade value a little bit. But I think I'm probably one of the few people on Sixers Twitter that is not totally against bringing Horford back and, like, seeing if maybe a year, you know, having played a year with these guys, like, maybe he's developed some chemistry with them, maybe they can deploy him in different ways, or, like, maybe his shooting just regresses to the mean. Like, he'd been shooting a lot better in Boston over the last few years, and his shooting just plummeted when he came to Philly, as is tradition for anyone who joins the Philadelphia 76ers over the last 5 years.
The only other guy I thought about, and I think it's hard to put this together for a bunch of reasons, but, I mean, I think it kind of gets under-discussed how bad of a contract Eric Gordon might have now.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you're looking for a guard, someone who can shoot, and Morey's familiar with him, obviously. But, I mean, there's a sizable gap in contract, right? I mean, it's like $10 million a year. But Gordon's got an extra year more than Horford. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, is there... Again, back to Tillman, I'm not sure he wants to spend another $10 million per year on this guy. But is there something there that could potentially make sense? I think the answer is no, just because you've got so much other money committed to Russ and to Harden. I don't think it's hard to even get one off the ground. Mm-hmm. But that's like the last contract I can see going down the list is one that maybe could make some iota of sense.
Yeah, if it was like Horford and Matisse and a first for Eric Gordon and Robert Covington, I sign off immediately.
Oh, now you're trying. That's like the one valuable player. Like the one guy who's like on a reasonable deal. PJ Tucker counts too, I guess. But yeah, good luck.
Yeah, I know. And I listened to the pod it was the Low Post pod with Zach Lowe and Yaron Weitzman. They brought him on after the Morey hire. And they were also trying to kick the tires of like where do any, you know, try to find an Al Horford deal that makes sense. And Mace, I don't know if you listened to that pod, but your own floated like Al Horford plus something for Drew Holiday. And I'm like, what is the plus something? Ben Simmons? Like,
That becomes even less likely with Stan Van Gundy in the one big situation, right? Yeah. Like, and I know you and I talked about the fact that, oh, well, Horford, if you're just throwing away the contract aspect, Horford actually didn't seem like that bad of a guy to put next to Zion, but like, they don't have enough to sweeten that pot enough to make it worth with Pelicans time, I don't think.
Right. Yeah. I mean, my favorite thing that I came up with was like Horford, I think it was Horford and Matisse or Horford and Korkmaz or something for Redick, Melly, and Darius Miller. Just because, I mean, it's hard for the Pelicans.
Fuck out of here.
I know. It's hard for the Pelicans to match contracts for Horford if they're not including Holiday. That's the tricky part as well. So,
yeah,
you know, it wouldn't shock me if the Sixers do not make a major trade this offseason. Like, I'm sure Morey will shop around for the next few weeks, but the market just might not be there for those guys. And like, I don't necessarily hate it as long as they, you know, they draft a shooter at 21. They have 4 second round picks. We'll see what they do with them. As long as they don't sell any for cash, I'm happy. I'm sure they'll try to use some of those as sweeteners to get off of one of these contracts as well. But like, if they add more shooters and add a point guard with the MLE, like I think they might not be poorly suited to just run it back next year and see what happens. And then, you know, the other question, I guess, is Josh Richardson, because he could be a free agent in, or he will be a free agent in 2021. And if they don't make a move, I don't think they're just going to have any appetite to re-sign him. So he could be a guy that you can either, you know, package with one of Horford or Harris, or just trade on his own. Yeah. But I'm fascinated to see what Daryl Morey does to this roster, both in the short term and the long term. Because, I mean, Mace, do you know, Morton, before all of this went down, was pretty adamant, like, at some point, we're going to have to break up Ben and Joel. You know, do you think if things go south for the Sixers again next year, that Morey arrives at that conclusion as well?
I mean, he's never been someone to shy away from being bold. So I think it's got to be a consideration. It all comes down to the offer, right? Like, what can you turn one of them into? And I'm very curious, if it comes to it, who gets moved.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you can make an argument for both, but even before Morey, but now I think with Morey, it's even more interesting, because while Simmons doesn't really shoot, he also facilitates a lot of the types of offense that Morey likes.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you value that in comparing to Embiid? I think that is almost as interesting as, do you move one of them, yes or no? Well, also, which one? So I guess, you know, we'll see. But I think it's got to be a consideration. You've got to do something quickly, right?
Yeah. And Mort, I know this came up, you know, immediately on Sixers Twitter upon his hire, was one, a potential Chris Paul deal. I guess that's the one possibility we didn't mention with Horford, but again,
right,
good luck finding the sweeteners. But, you know, down the road, if things go south with Ben and Joe, and, you know, things go south at Houston, like, could Morey try to bring James Harden to Philly? And if so, would one of Ben or Joe plus whatever else you need, would that be enough to swing that deal?
I think it depends on, you know, who it is, and I think it depends on where they are at that stage. But I don't find it impossible whatsoever. I mean, Morey hitched his wagon in many respects to Harden. I mean, it was like his entire reputation just hinged on that Harden trade. And when it worked out for him, he really was genuinely, you know, happy to display that commitment to James was there all the way through. So I think he will always have significant interest in bringing Harden wherever he goes.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't rule that out whatsoever. In terms of what needs to be given up, that's just a little bit too far down the road, because what if Ben Simmons starts shooting threes and hitting them, and he becomes this uber efficient player overall, while still, as Mason pointed out, being one of the primary playmakers in the league who actually generates, I think it's the third most three-pointers in the league or something along those lines. Like, he's really high up on that list for mm-hmm. guys who generates three-pointers, which is such a huge aspect of well, floor spacing nowadays as well. Like, do you want to give that up eventually if he becomes that type of player for a James Harden who'll be 32, 33, maybe 34 at that time? I think no. So, again, it boils down to situation and timing.
Yeah. And one thing I would emphasize, or at least I hope, I mean, we haven't had the Daryl Morey press conference yet, and I'm sure this will be asked. But, you know, the whole idea of Ben and Joe not being a fit with quote-unquote Morey ball, I think it might be somewhat flawed on the premise, just because we can't necessarily assume that. I think Morey ball, you know, obviously they emphasize a ton of threes. The emphasis on isolations over the past few years, I think that was more tailored to, I have James Harden, who is one of the best on-ball creators, and he has this step-back three that is basically unguardable. Let's take advantage of it. But I don't necessarily think that Daryl Morey is coming into Philly is like, all right, we're going to have Ben Simmons play iso ball 20 possessions a game.
Maury's about coaching efficient offense, or running an efficient offense. And if that's James Harden, your best, one of the best iso players in NBA history, you know, doing that, then yeah, that's it. And I think you're right. It's not like he's going to be so tied to one. I think the one thing we can safely say is that mid-range shots are the devil. I mean, that's about as far as I'll go with Maury. Like, that's it.
Right. Yeah, and I noted this. I wrote, you know, when he got hired, I wrote something for Forbes Sports. The Sixers were high on the list last year in terms of mid-range shots. I know Matt Moore of the Action Network has been harping on Joel Embiid in particular in that regard. But Josh Richardson, Tobias Harris, even Al Horford were also culprits for, you know, they would, like, dribble around and then just pull up for, like, a 16-footer that had no chance. And I think that we'll see less of. As Mort, you were right on the money. Tobias Harris led the team last year with 5 three-point attempts per game. There were 5 Rockets who attempted more than 5 points or 5 threes per game, including, like, Daniel House. I think all but one of them was less efficient from three than Tobias Harris was. So I think you're 100% right. Like, his three-point attempts might not take 10 a game, but like 7 or 8 should absolutely be the expectation for him next year.
Oh, that has to be like the bottom tier, the least expected. So one thing I will note here with Joel Embiid as well, because you just brought up the mid-ranger. You know, I think the Sixers fan needs to get acquainted with, you know, how well Joel Embiid shoots within 3 feet of the basket, because, like Mason said, you know, Maury is focused on running an efficient offense. Embiid, close to the basket within 3 feet, is shooting over 72% from the field. I wouldn't be surprised whatsoever if he basically has Joel cut out the mid-range, somewhat cut out the three, even though he has to, you know, make defenses stay honest and just goes, you know, you need to be Shaq down there. Look, you're 7'2", 280. Go eat.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you've got guys like Furkan and Shake coming off the bench. We don't know what Shake's going to be. He could be a starter for all we know. But yeah, I'm assuming Maury's going to say, all right, permanent green light for both of you as well. Like, if they bring Alec Burks back, permanent green light for you. Because when a guy like Alec Burks is just like a breath of fresh air to your team, that speaks to how philosophically behind you are. Like, Alec Burks creating off the dribble and shooting was like, holy crap, you're allowed to do that?
Yeah.
Like, that's not a good sign. So I think we'll see a lot more of that next year. I mean, Mace, you brought up Maury and Doc, and I think they spent some time together in Boston, I believe, and appear to have some mutual respect in the years since. But, you know, that's kind of my biggest question right now going forward is, like, you know, usually when a team overhauls everyone, it is hire the top and then start hiring down. The Sixers work backward, hired Doc and then hired some other front office guys and then bring in Maury. Not to say that Maury wouldn't have hired Doc, but, like, are these guys on the same page philosophically? Like, is Doc willing to adhere to, you know, quote unquote Maury ball as much as Mike D'Antoni did? Like, D'Antoni and Maury had very clear synergy together to the point where they just punted on starting a center at all. It was radical, but it was super fun. And I, you know, it's like the actual movie Moneyball, where you're like, you know, the manager just would not buy into what Billy Beane was selling until Billy Beane was like, all right, cool, I'm going to trade all of our players until you actually buy into it. You know, are Maury and Doc aligned philosophically, or is there going to be a conflict at some point? I don't think we can know the answer to that question yet.
Yeah. Yep. Hard to say, but also I feel like, you would know more about this topic than me, admittedly, but I mean, do you feel like there was any discussion with Doc or anyone else before this, or it was just like, oh, Maury's available, we got to go get him? Like, because I almost feel like, Like I said, I'm very skeptical when it comes to anything that the Houston Rockets do from a management perspective, and who knows if this actually was in the works before Maury even left, and even before Doc was hired. Like, who knows, right? Like, my level of skepticism here is probably a little high.
No, I'm with you.
But there is a chance, right, that you knew before you hired Doc that Maury might be the guy you're bringing in.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, Shams, I think, was the one who reported when Maury stepped down the Sixers immediately reached out and have like kind of been working on this for the past 2 weeks. So I would hope they at least like mentioned that to Doc, you know, because he's been hiring some assistant coaches in the meantime. They brought in the guy from the Pacers. So yeah, like I don't think this developed out of absolutely nowhere, and they had even expressed interest in Morey 2 years ago after Brian Colangelo resigned. So like their interest in him definitely should not have come as a surprise. And I think the question was just like, would they be willing to actually make this move? But
yeah, I mean, it's probably like a Vivek and Buddy Hield situation where he's probably got posters of Morey all over his office. Right. And just like, you know, as soon as the opportunity presented itself, he went and got him. So everyone in the organization knew it was going to happen. They just didn't know at what time it would happen. And now, apparently now is the time.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I'm just morbidly intrigued. Like Zach Lowe was saying on his pod as well. It's like the morbid fascination with the Sixers. We were like ready to just cut him out, be like, nope, we just cast you off. And you're an also ran, like you'll win 45 games and then get knocked out in the first round. We don't have to devote brain power to you. And now it's like, but now they just brought in Daryl Morey and Doc Rivers. And then, you know, they got Dan Burke, who assistant coach who's been with the Pacers for 20 plus years and is like the architect of their defense. It's just always better than it should be. They just got Sam Cassell for an assistant coach as well. Dave Yeager, like they're just going to be so interesting again. And I don't know if it's going to work or just completely blow up in their faces, but like now I'm going to have to closely follow this team begrudgingly. Again, I thought I was almost free.
But then they pulled you back in.
They do it every year.
Yeah.
Guys, let's wrap up quickly because they were not the only team with assistant coaching news in the East. The Brooklyn Nets just hired Mike D'Antoni and Ime Udoka to work under Steve Nash in Brooklyn. Mace, what do you think of these hires, especially given, you know, Nash very inexperienced in terms of coaching?
It's certainly something. I mean, they've stockpiled their coaching talent, that's for sure. And I mean, Steve Nash is now at best the fourth most qualified head person to coach that team. And so the power dynamic is certainly interesting. But I feel like I feel like Steve Nash, less than maybe some other hoaxes, is not going to be some power thirsty person who I feel like he's the right guy to have a team sort of coaching dynamic almost. So in that respect, I think it could work out okay. But I mean, you've got Jacques Vaughn, who I thought was just absolutely a fine candidate to be head coach for the Nets. Obviously, you've got the strings being pulled by KD and Kyrie, but you know, behind him D'Antoni. So D'Antoni's no longer even the associate head coach because that's Jacques Vaughn. And so you've got and then Udoka, who was a name that was floated for certain head coaching vacancies. I know he was a guy that a lot of people were hoping would come and be an assistant in New Orleans. You know, under Stan Van Gundy. And so you know, it's certainly interesting, and I think they've got a lot there. How they delineate roles, responsibilities, all that will be kind of what I'm most interested in. But you know, kudos to them for pulling that kind of a group together, and good for Steve Nash. I mean, he's got to sign off on that, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, maybe he doesn't, but I would assume that, you know, they want buy-in from him on his own staff. And so, I mean, that could be threatening especially to some first-time head coaches who haven't coached very much at all. And so, you know, hopefully it works out okay. But, I mean, I could see ways that this goes south, you know?
Yeah. Well, Mort, I know, you know, Kyrie, pre all of these hires, was saying, like, we don't even necessarily have a coach. Like, one day I could be coach, or one day Kevin Durant could be coach. So now you throw two, you know, assistant/previous head coaches in the mix, and that only further muddies the water in some respect, right?
Yeah, so basically the Nets should be known as the seven head coaches or less, right? Someone on Twitter wrote that, and that was just fantastic.
That was a lame joke. I'm just going on record and saying that.
I like it. Aww. I like it.
Well, either way, it's definitely, I agree with Mason that there are a lot of avenues that they can go where this can fail dramatically, so because this is a lot of chefs, and then you're throwing, you know, Kyrie as a person with his thoughts and ideas and concepts and ideologies, and look, I'm just not very high on the Nets. I said as much when they signed Kyrie and Kevin Durant. You know that I was skeptical. I'm not sitting here with a changed heart after these hires. I'm intrigued, much as I am intrigued by the Sixers of what they did, because this is going to be fascinating. But am I hopeful that this is going to turn into like a championship contender? No, not at all. I'm just as skeptical as before. Nothing's changed in that regard. It's just a different kind of skeptic.
Yeah, I forget who said this on Twitter, and I apologize for stealing this idea, but someone was like that the 2020-2021 Nets are probably going to be a lot like the 2019-2020 Clippers, where they have the talent on paper, but a lot of the focus all year is going to be on their chemistry, and that's probably going to end up making or breaking whether they could actually live up to all of that talent. So, I mean, you know, on paper, like, Mike D'Antoni handles the offense. Ime Udoka handles the defense. Jacques Vaughn handles all of the day-to-day game planning, whatever, that, like, Steve Nash just has no experience doing because he's never coached before. And then Steve Nash could handle the ego management and, like, rotations and making sure Kyrie and KD and DeAndre Jordan don't poison the locker room. So, like, the roles, you could see how they would make sense. But, yeah, I am just fascinated to see how all of it unfolds in reality, because you know it's just not going to be as smooth as they're hoping.
Over under 25 games before Kyrie Irving throws someone under the bus.
25 healthy games or 25
25 games played for the team, because look, he didn't even play when he threw the team under the bus the last time.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was getting at. How many games in the season, I guess, is the bigger question. 50 or 72?
Yeah. Somewhere along those lines.
Yeah. No, it's a fair question. And you know, I think if nothing else, the Atlantic division in the NBA between, you know, the Sixers and the Nets, with all of this turnover, you've still got the Celtics, who are probably fuming about they realistically probably should have been in the finals this year and blew it. Got Toronto doing whatever. We'll see what they do this offseason. And then the Knicks are just always the wild card in that division. Like, no division in the NBA will be more interesting to follow this offseason and heading into next season than the Atlantic. So get
the
ready
Knicks
for a lot
have
of
better
East Coast
team chemistry than the Nets. Think about that for a
let's hope. Yeah, there'll be a lot of East Coast bias going this year. I think that's a good place to wrap up. So Mace, thank you again for joining us today. One more time, can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and where they can find your work?
Yeah, sure. Had a great time, y'all. Thanks for having me. So it's just my name, Mason Ginsburg, on Twitter. And again, check out our In the Know podcast series on Blue Wire Network. We're doing a lot of fun stuff in the offseason, talking about not just the Pelicans, but all the other teams in the NBA. Well, we may skip the Lakers, actually. So 28 teams. We'll figure it out.
Well, please, yeah, tune in to Mace's offseason previews, and I look forward to you guys inviting me on when the Pelicans do trade Drew Holiday for Al Horford and question mark. We'll see what the question mark ends up being.
I will cry.
In the meantime, please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek. I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen and our special guest, Mason Ginsburg. Have a good weekend, guys.
You too, man. Don't die.